Welcome to the Disruptance Podcast. The Disruptance Podcast is the show that disrupts the way entrepreneurs think to make them more profitable and impactful. Rethink tired and outdated business norms to welcome innovation and unlock your unlimited possibilities. Here are your hosts, Eric Forney and Greg Fowler.
Eric, we got another great one today for the audience. And without any further ado, we'll dive right into this particular episode of Disruptance. And the topic for today, completely off the cuff, as per usual, is to get your perspective, my friend, and dive deep into best advice that anyone will ever receive in their life. And it's been thrown around a lot. Day in, day out, you hear and see all these things that are said aimlessly. And some people take things to heart, and maybe they should, maybe they shouldn't. So I want to know, when I go through this list from you, Eric, do you agree with this piece of advice? Do you disagree? And kind of why or what your thoughts are, if that makes any sense.
Okay. So what's that?
No, go ahead.
Oh, no, I didn't know if you needed my thoughts already. Was that you prompting me for my thoughts? No. Okay, cool.
All right, you're ready, Eric. I know it. You're ready to dive into this one, man. Okay.
I was excited.
Let me start with the first one. So I curated all of these questions, right? These thoughts, these pieces of advice from all over the internet, right? And a lot of this is going to come up and people are going to hear and understand. It's like, oh, yeah, I've heard that before. Oh, yeah, I agree with that. No, that's a bunch of garbage. So I really want to get your perspective. So let's jump into the first one, Eric, which is the thought of do what is right, not what is easy. Do you agree? Do you disagree? Why? What are your thoughts?
Generally, I can't think of a scenario where that's the wrong advice. So I'm going to go with that's great advice. I don't know that there's ever a wrong time to do the right thing. Now, you could make a decent argument that says that Google Glass was the right thing at the wrong time. And so, sure, if you were in the business of trying to stay in business by doing the right thing, building Google Glass AR technology 10 years before the world was even thinking about being ready for it, fine. But otherwise, as a general rule of thumb, I would tell my 6-year-old that there's never the wrong time to do the right thing.
I love that. And Eric, I would side with that side of the equation. I think doing the right thing and not necessarily what's easy. So many people are looking for an easy button or an easy way out. And I think that's not always the case. Sometimes they line up, but most of the time they don't. And here, I want to throw an additional caveat into this too, Eric. As I go through these questions, agree, disagree in your thoughts. But if you have examples that stick out to you that you've actually practiced some of this, anything that comes to mind, not for everyone, but if something stands out, I want to hear it. I want to hear a story behind it if you got one.
I probably remember the ways that I violate it more than the ways that I honor it.
I love this. All right. So let me jump into the next one here, Eric, because this one, I get your perspective on it. So don't make decisions when you're angry or when you're really enthusiastic or excitable. So if you're really mad or you're really happy, you probably shouldn't make decisions. Thoughts, pros, cons, agree, disagree.
I mean, it's probably good marriage advice. It's probably good advice when thinking about getting a tattoo, when skydiving, or anything else that might threaten your livelihood. That's probably sound advice. Now, the reality of it is sometimes it's a hell yes and sometimes it's a hell no. And so I think about the enthusiasm of it is that, I remember, I guess it was probably a year ago, year and a half ago, whatever it was. I got a text and from text, Adam said, hey, do you want to go on this vacation? I need an answer from you in the next like 12 hours because, Eric, you're not really good at responding to text messages quickly. So if I don't get an answer, I'm going to move on. And he said, here's this vacation that we're doing. Are you in or no? And and in the moment, I was like, nah, not really. Like, it didn't sound like it was going to be my thing. It was going to be, we were on a boat. We were going to be on a boat with 8 strangers, okay? Mm-hmm. And that's not really my jam. I'm just envisioning it's this, like, riverboat kind of deal. It's like a houseboat maybe in, like, Dale Hollow, Tennessee or something. I don't know. And that's awesome. That's what went through my mind. But, you know, by the time I got home, I decided for some reason to YouTube it. And I YouTubed the boat that he had invited us to go on. And probably within 30 seconds, out of pure excitement, I went ahead and just said, yes, we're going. I didn't ask my wife. I didn't check the calendar. I saw, you know, 30 seconds worth of a clip, and I was hyped about it. And it was a hell yes. And afterwards, it was also a hell yes. So there are exceptions, but for life altering, one way door decisions, good advice.
Yeah. And you hit it right on the head too early on, you know, marital advice. I mean, everybody's heard, don't go to bed angry. You know, anybody that's been married.
My wife would have filed for divorce by now, if that were the case, Craig. She'd have left my ass the first day we got married.
You and me both, my friend. Yeah. Love it. So, okay. Next piece of this, this particular puzzle, or the best advice that anybody would ever receive, may or may not. Don't make assumptions. So never assume anything, good, bad, thoughts.
Yeah, that's a good, man. I don't know. That one's a little too hard, fast rule. You know, if your child is running in a parking lot, Greg, you should assume that is putting them in danger. And yet, if you're walking down an alley and there are five men wearing ski masks, you should assume that it's not the safest time you've ever had in your life. There are some times that you should assume that that the probability of an event taking place is the probability. And there are other times in which you should assume that people have the best intent.
Fair enough.
It's art, no science.
Well, and I agree with that thought process, especially with the ski masks. I mean, what are they shooting, a music video, or, you know, are they going to rob a bank?
Right. Is it Halloween? I think because they may be coming for your candy. That might be what it is.
Well, that's a deal breaker for me, my friends. No one messes with the candy. So in this instance here, in order to get, you have to give. So it's kind of the help others, you know, achieve their goals and success, and you'll achieve theirs. Thoughts, pros, cons, agree, disagree.
Yeah, you know, I'm not much of a historian, but I have paid enough attention to Congress to know that that is not true. Congress is happy to get from you by giving you nothing. So there are some areas where they give you nothing and they take wholly in return. There's plenty of instances of that. Is it a general good practice? Of course. The unfortunate part is, again, it's art and not exclusively science. You know, there are times in which I've lived my life where it made sense to think about reciprocity. And now I no longer live by the reciprocity rule. Is just because someone opted to give me something doesn't entitle them for me to give something in return. Because here's the thing, is if you give something with the expectation of getting something in return, you didn't give it with good intent.
Well said.
If you ask someone to do you a favor, but you expect compensation, it was never a favor. When you check out with the barista and they have that shitty card reader that automatically prompts you to tip them for merely handing something off a shelf, it doesn't require that you give in return. And so there are plenty of use cases where it's a good practice, but enough outliers where it's not a rule. Yeah, is that not the worst?
And I would agree.
Like the tip button. How do we get Congress to ban that? Like, could they have not sent that in the Ukraine bill for more funding? Is we could, like, just the tip jar, all the tips they go to fund the federal government and any pet projects of theirs. We use the tip button for that. It's all it's good for at this point.
Eric, I think the right example to that is, first, I don't think we can rely on the government for anything. So let's just throw that out right there and there. But to respond to the tipping, I mean, it's out of control. I mean, look, I am the biggest sucker for giving, you know, plenty of gratuity to somebody who's done a wonderful job. It made myself and my family's experience top notch. I mean, I'm all about it.
Totally.
But the just obligatory, here you go, because it popped up on the screen, you handed me an ice cream cone. I'm going to give you, you know, $5, you know, when the ice cream was $8. I mean, I to me, it just kills me, you know, for sure. And again, to each their own. Hopefully we're touching a hot spot there, because that's a part of this too. So going into this, Eric, I want to go over another one, which is hopefully some of the best advice that anyone would ever receive in their life they could apply. Luck comes from hard work. Agree,
no.
Disagree?
No, it doesn't. It doesn't. Listen, I mean, there are plenty of people that work really hard and are incredibly unlucky. And you know, all you have to do is think about if you were working hard shoeing horses in 1918, little did you know you were about to get run over by the Model T. The hard work did not create any additional luck for you. So it is a component of luck, but it is not the singular determiner of increasing your probability of becoming lucky with something. The reality is that sometimes you have to be good at spotting and identifying trends, executing on them consistently, getting some stroke of luck. I would argue I've had a lot of luck in life. And I also work hard, but those two things are not mutually exclusively linked. And so some of it largely has to do with riding waves and finding trends that make you incredibly effective. You know, it's interesting. I was just was listening a few days ago. Tim Ferriss was talking about the fact that he didn't think he could replicate his podcast all over again if he had to. And that's because, you know, he founded his podcast 12 years ago, and it just so happened to be on the heels of the 4-hour work week. Well, if he rewrote the 4-hour work week today, most of what's in the 4-hour work week is no longer applicable. Like, it's not a good strategy for you to post ads on Craigslist in order to minimize a portion of your work week. And so he can't still apply the same methods, tactics, and practices that were in the book that were the catalyst to him gaining followers and listeners to his podcast. Both of which were the lucky coincidence of timing and predicting a wave. Joe Rogan talks about that. When, you know, he was one of the early podcasters. It started out as him and his friends just screwing around. He had comedians. They would, you know, smoke joints and do comedian stuff and record it. And then eventually he did a show and all of his audience had indicated that they'd listened to his podcast. He said it wasn't until his first audience was more vocal about being a subscriber and a listener to his podcast than to his comedy that he realized he actually was onto something. A large portion of that was purely dependent on the timing and knowing where the puck was going. If Joe Rogan tried to start a newspaper instead, wouldn't have worked. If he tried to start a TV station, wouldn't have worked. They call it fear factor. It wouldn't have worked. And so the reality is that he had to combine hard work with luck and riding a wave of having some vision of where the future is going.
Well, and I really love that perspective too, Eric, because there's a certain amount of velocity and effort that has to do with it. Hard work, as others would kind of dictate it, but being effective and efficient, I think, is really a key component to that. It's, you know, there's lots of people that are working extremely hard, and it's, everyone's heard this piece of advice, didn't make the list though. This is an honorable mention: work harder, not smarter, you know, or smarter, not harder sort of scenario. Yeah. And I think that indicator to me is, it speaks volumes to this. You know, you make your own luck when it comes down to that. And I think that makes a ton of sense. However, I thought you were going to mention Tim Ferriss not being able to repeat the podcast because disruptance came into the wave. And, you know, unfortunately,
that's what it was. Yeah, that's what it was, for sure. For sure. Yeah.
You know, that's where you were going with it. And then smoking joints, Eric, I mean, you might be onto something here. I mean, disruptance, you know, might end up going there. Who knows? Stay tuned, everybody. You might see Eric and I in another light.
It's not legal yet in Indiana, so I don't know about Massachusetts. Is it Massachusetts? No,
I think it is.
Yeah, we're one of the last holdouts here. We're still holding out. And you know what? It's 1 o'clock in the afternoon right now. I don't know that rolling a blunt would be really great for my workday today. So we might have to reschedule the pod if that's what we go with. Okay.
That's right. We might go with the comedian route instead of the informative entrepreneurial route. You know, I think that's the way to go.
That'd be fair.
I think that's
fair
where,
enough.
Where they'll go hand in glove. So next piece of advice, treat others the way you want to be treated. Pretty self-explanatory. Do you agree? Do you disagree? What are your thoughts on it? Treating people the way you want to be treated.
I think that's probably good advice. Now, you know, you could argue that there's a cousin to it that says, you know, sometimes you might need to treat people up to their potential as well. And so that might be just slightly different, but I think they're the same thing, which is if, you know, even if that was your level of potential or your level of willingness or aptitude, treat them that way, the way that you would want to be treated. So I could accept that. You know, I think that they give some attribution to this Jesus guy around that rule. And so I'd say it's survived a couple thousand decades. It's probably a couple thousand years. It's probably worth assuming that it's rooted in good foundation.
I would say so, Eric. And the golden rule, as I guess they would say it from a religious standpoint. I want to press this a little bit, though, because you sparked a thought into my mind as we were going through with treating people the way you want to be treated. The assumption being that individual on the receiving end is similar to you, right? Some people want to be more directly spoken to and get to the point. Let me know what I need. I don't want any, you know, hand holding and or the water cooler talk. I want to get to work. And others, they don't want to be treated that way. They want to be finessed and relational. And so I don't know if that's 100% case by case. I think what you are leading into, Eric, is know your audience, put yourself in their shoes and treat them the way that they want to be treated, not necessarily just the way that we want to be treated. Does that make sense?
Correct. Yeah, it absolutely does. I mean, it's the premise of empathy, right? And the premise of empathy being that you're really taking them. I like to think of empathy as method acting, really, in that if I were Daniel Day-Lewis and I were growing my beard and adding lifts to my shoes, I would be preparing for the role of Abraham Lincoln, you know, pre-theater Abraham Lincoln. And I would be preparing for Honest Abe, and I would become that person. That's empathy to me, is that you're understanding the person from the perspective of, if I were them experiencing what I'm experiencing, what would I be feeling, thinking, believing, telling myself? What are the stories and what are the emotions that I'm encountering? And then mirroring that back to the person, if you're, you know, you're the person who's providing the empathy, is I'm doing method acting, I'm understanding, and then I'm mirroring it back.
I love that. And I think that piece of advice rings true to any relationship, whether it's a business or a personal relationship from a leadership standpoint. I think that sounds. So I think we
and
both
that's
agree.
Because there's nothing worse than sympathy, Greg. There's nothing worse than sympathy. Like, probably the worst thing as an adult man on the planet that someone can be is sympathetic. Like, there is nothing more emasculating than sympathy. That's just like the little boy in you can't stand the sympathy. So I could do empathy, no sympathy though. I don't need a Band-Aid on my boo-boo. It's okay.
That's gonna say, kiss the boo boo. Whatever ends up happening, not here, not on this show, everybody. So on this piece of advice, and I already almost kind of know where your head's at with this, but I want to I want the audience to hear it. Learn something new every day. Do you agree? Do you disagree? Thoughts? Why?
I think it's a good strategy. It's a general good positive rule of thumb. At a certain point, what you probably need to do is stop learning things new and re-cement the great practices that you've forgotten or failed to implement or execute on. So, for instance, I have not bought a book or listened to a new book or learned a lot of new concepts in a while, because what I found is the more I learn, the more I find that some of the earliest things that I learned that were successful hold up to be timeless and principle based. Wow. And there's so many things that you could learn. And yet what you really need to think about is what are the learnings that stand the test of time? Like simplicity, like focus, like creativity, the way to interact with people, sales, microeconomics. There are learnings that are timeless, and those are the ones that are worth learning on an ongoing basis and relearning. And then there's everything else. I probably don't need to go learn about, I did just learn about the fake trip that we made to the moon. You know, some people believe it, right? You're entitled to your own conspiracy.
What's wrong with them?
Yeah. choose to believe in Santa Claus and unicorns if you want to. But I understand the difference is I learned that the details that were surrounding the post World War II initiative for America to pretend to go to the moon and that's great. That's educational tourism. Mm-hmm. That's edutainment. I get it. I was doing that because it was enjoyable. Mm-hmm. Because some of us don't watch sitcoms, we choose documentaries, and that's okay. Knowing the difference between the two,
sure,
is the difference. It doesn't mean though that I'm going to learn it and then apply it and think that now I'm going to take the lessons from the moon landing and apply them to other walks of life. That was purely from an enjoyable standpoint.
Well, but I agree with that in the standpoint that there's edutainment that way, you know, being educated and entertained simultaneously. And there's a mind break in some of those occasions, and sitcoms, documentary, whatever floats your boat. I think as long as you're tuning into Disruptance, you're in the right place as far as I'm concerned. But with this instance, though, Eric, I want to ask you a question. This is not on the list. I was just curious.
Is it about the moon landing?
It is not. It is
okay,
not.
Okay, cool. However, I'm not an expert.
However, was it suspended with cables? How'd they make it look like they were floating? I mean, that's the real idea. But with the content stacking, have you heard of this concept, or have you done this concept where you take one very specific type of learned information, and instead of reading several different books from several different topics, if you're doing that, say you're reading a book a month, 12 books a year, instead of having 12 different topics, pick one topic to master and read everything you can in that genre. Have you ever done that? Like, what are your thoughts on that?
Yeah, that sounds right. Absolutely, I've done it. And candidly, like, I'll tell you the worst topic to go learn, and one that you have to, and one that you probably are doing both on-site learning, and it's an internship, and some days you're highly unpaid or underpaid, and yet you're doing some like book work and reading and trying to study and learn from others. And that's leadership. Mm. I'll tell you, there are a lot of really bad leadership books, and I'm not sure the good ones from the bad ones. That's one that can do more confusion than anything. And so what I found is I would do the loop of really focusing on trying to learn leadership and by consuming as much leadership content as possible. What you eventually find is that most of the leadership advice is actually circular. And what I mean by that is, you know, I love to pick on John Maxwell. And by the way, like, John Maxwell is probably like the best presenter and communicator. It's John Maxwell 1 and then me 2, whatever bastardization of the English language I do on a regular basis. And my wife was making fun of me last week for that. The fact that like I somehow fluctuate between passive and active sentences on an ongoing basis for some reason. But nonetheless, John Maxwell is this amazing communicator. But what I found to be so difficult about studying and learning and reading his teachings and books is that they conflict with each other. And by that, what I mean is in one episode, John might say, Greg, life is a game of inches. And it's a game of inches. The difference between safe and out at first base is sometimes just a game of inches. Sure. And next week's episode is don't sweat the small stuff. You know, the devil is in the details, Greg. Just don't sweat the small stuff. And you're like, no, damn it, John, which one is it? You just told me last week that it was a game of inches, and this week I don't sweat the small stuff. Here I am. I'm walking around sweaty with a ruler trying to figure out what it really is. And eventually I just gave up attempting to read and study leadership books and realize, okay, I've consumed as much as possible. I've consumed to the point of confusion. Mm-hmm. What are the patterns that show up consistently? And what do I believe to be true? And then how do I go execute and implement consistently? But the truth of the matter is there are, leadership is not a science at all. You could spend the next week arguing with ChatGPT over leadership. And what you'll find is even the smartest invention of mankind still can't clearly define leadership either. And therefore we have to understand that it is situational. It is almost all art and very little science. And that's what I found through overstudying topics at times is everything works and nothing works. It's all situational.
Wow. But I think that you're taking it from a perspective of learning and then relearning and applying and, you know, finding your truth, right? Because at the end of the day, there's a multitude of opinions and perspectives and what is hitting properly today versus what's different 5 years from now or 6 months from now. And I think that's good advice, kind of continually to educate yourself, but re-educate and don't try to go too wide or too deep because you're going to get muddied and lost. I think that there's a fine line there, as you mentioned, Eric. That to me makes perfect sense.
I mean, the complexity of leadership is fascinating. All you have to do is look at history. You know, there you see that, you know, the winners of wars and the writers of history books determine the winners and the losers. It doesn't necessarily always give you a representation of who was the real winners and losers. It's typically just the rearview mirror perspective. And so just, you know, off the top of my head, what comes to mind is, you know, more books are written about Abraham Lincoln than about Jesus. And I can only assume that Abraham Lincoln, therefore, was a good leader. I've got a pretty good guess that says that Jesus was a pretty good leader as well, because I'm confident that he's actually touched more lives across the world than Abraham Lincoln did. And they had very different styles. Now, you could make an argument that Ulysses S. Grant, Robert E. Lee, and, you know, Stalin and someone else over there in Germany were also leaders of large audiences and large groups of people at a time. And yet, when you look at the history books, you would say that it's not, there were leadership principles that they all adopted that that allowed them to have great followings. There were deviations in motive and in direction that caused history books to say these were terrible leaders.
You know, that that sparks up an episode idea, Eric, and I think maybe in the future we can.
Don't get me canceled, Greg. Okay, well, don't do it.
Where I'm getting going with this, Eric, is looking at, you know, leaders of the past and not necessarily good leaders. I think that there's some villainy that's out there that people are interested in, but you take Napoleon, you take, you know, Hitler. I mean,
you got Genghis Khan. I mean, there's a lot of them. Yeah.
I think that's an interest to say, take the good from the bad. We'll see. Maybe stay tuned, everybody. That might be.
Don't get me canceled.
No, did they just say that? So here's the next best piece of advice that anyone's ever received on this list.
Yeah, no,
trust your instincts. Do you agree with that? Disagree?
Sure. Again, if you're wondering if that person that you are debating whether to swipe left or right with on Tinder based on appearance is something that you should trust on your instinct, the answer is absolutely. okay? Mm-hmm. There's some things that aren't worth risking your health over, and there are some things that you should trust your instinct on, like, you know, walking down a dark alley with people in ski masks, not a great idea. taking a toy gun to a protest, not a strong strategy. There are a lot of things that you should trust your instinct on. However, most of the time, you should trust the advice you got from your grandma and data. And that's it.
Okay. In grandma, we trust.
In grandma, we trust. Here's why, Greg, because, you know, the good news is grandma's lived long enough to see a lot of shit in her life, and especially your grandma. She had to put up with you, and she had to deal with everything else that came with it. And because of that, there's some staying power in the wisdom that's earned over life expectancy. And so I look at, you know, candidly, if I get doomery about the future of the economy or of the American experiment, you know, I look to Warren Buffett, Charlie Munger, when he was still living. And, you know, here are two guys who went on to become billionaires. They started out as poor, but at the time they were middle class or upper middle class, but by today's standard they would be incredibly poor, and yet one of them went on to be the wealthiest investor in history, and the other one was co-pilot to the wealthiest investor in history. Their general wisdom for approaching life is incredibly profound and largely undefeated. You just don't want to take advice from them on technology, how to download a PDF, unlock an iPhone with your face, or buy Bitcoin. But otherwise, they give out great advice.
Well, that's perspective onto who you're entrusting with your mind, your headspace, right? The mind share, if you will. I think that's important, kind of harping back to the learning thing.
And by the way, not all data needs to be trusted either. Greg, you know, if you want to go down the rabbit hole, you could look at some of the data around, like, Prilosec, for instance, or the way that that industries or marketers position data in order to tell narratives to make you emotionally feel a particular way. And so, you know, there are relative statistics and there are absolute statistics, and they can be cherry picked to tell stories that are favorable to whatever the desired story is. And so the only data really worth looking at is a complete set of 360 concentric data regarding whatever it is that you're trying to understand and learn in order to formulate the best opinion. But I'll take typically fairly concentric and comprehensive data and trust that way more than instinct.
And I appreciate that for sure. I mean, a lot of people throw around, you know, intuition and, you know, trusting your gut feeling. And I think ultimately there's a lot of thought process into that. And the duality of the research phase, I think you and I discussed this on a way early episode. We're talking about maybe not. We were talking about flat earthers. Did we talk about that?
I think we briefly touched on it. I didn't add that one to my treasure chest of conspiracies, though, so I don't remember enough.
Right. It should be in there if it's not in there.
It should be.
The idea is, I guess if you pull this up in a study, I haven't done this myself, so I don't want a bunch of hate on this, everybody, if this isn't the case. But if you go to the internet and you look up all the information you can about, is the Earth flat? You could find enough to kind of convince yourself that the Earth is flat.
Totally.
And the same principle applies on the complete opposite argument to that. Mm-hmm. So again, there's two sides to the coin. There's duality. And I think that, you know, taking the time, not just trusting your instincts or your gut, but using your brain, your heart, you know, sort of combination, I think is the right way to go about it.
Yeah. This is where you marry it with AI, Greg, candidly, is, and I didn't say marry AI. I don't want people to get, you know, we already have a problem with people living in their parents' basements. We don't need to propagate more of that theme. So
I think there's movies like that, Eric, where there's like artificial intelligence. I think there's like Scarlett Johansson and there was Joaquin Phoenix.
I'm sure there's a lot of movies where people are married to robots and all kinds of things, Greg. It's, you know, that's not really my thing, though. But what's interesting is there's been some fascinating research around confronting or communicating and having conversation with AI around different instincts or gut instincts or conspiracies that you might have, what people have found is that actually AI has been incredibly effective at helping people see additional concentric perspectives that they don't have. You know, like the one that they use a lot is that day in September where those two towers fell. I don't want to get canceled on YouTube here. So you can actually go on and have a conversation with AI about whether you believe that that took place or not. What they found in the research is that it's been incredibly effective at helping people see a lot of different perspectives that they otherwise were either unwilling to hear from people or that they were unaware of all of the aggregated data and information. So the amazing part in me saying that is that you no longer actually need to trust your instinct. You could also trust the phone in your pocket and the smartest innovation in human history.
Love that. No, and again, that's that whole topic of good, bad, or indifferent advice. I think that this is here. And we'll continue the list. The habits you establish now last you the rest of your life. So is no. That agree, disagree? Yeah.
That's a straight up no. Hell no. No, I mean, listen, contrary to what most would assume, I'm not a neurosurgeon. However, when you look at most of the research around how your brain forms early in your life, what you find is you've got, you know, the neural pathways and the synapse, how it formulates initially with what I would kind of consider to be like cause and effect. Mm. And so you think that, you know, you cry as a baby and you learn that crying manipulates the environment to get you your desired result, milk, fresh diaper, whatever it is.
Sure.
You learn that there are patterns to how you act cause a opposite or a desired reaction. Mm-hmm. And eventually, as we're kids, those pathways are fairly well solidified and formed. Mm-hmm. Now, so if you had have said the habits or the pathways, the thinking that you build as a child determines the way that you think and the habits that you carry in as an adult, I would have accepted that as a partially true. Mm-hmm. However, as an adult, most of us have to create systems that allow us to maintain the desired habits that we want. And if we change our environment, if we learn nothing from COVID other than don't lock kids out of public schools, if we learned the second thing, what we should have learned is that all of our habits are actually subject to the change of our environment. Wow. We're just a product of our environment for the most part.
You know, and I agree with that. And that the idea behind what we're establishing today is going to be everlasting, I think, is kind of a silly piece of advice. I mean, your habits are going to evolve as you evolve and change. And now there's a possibility and directive to say that one habit can compound onto the next habit and over long periods of time start to shape. But I think that is flawed in nature. I would agree with that. I would actually disagree with that, statement. So bad piece of advice. What's going on here?
Habits are really incredibly hard to start, by the way, as well. I mean, There's a ton of research around what's required. And, you know, again, if you think about the evolutionary aspect of formulating habits are taxing taxing on your neurosystem. If you were, you know, we're on a Conestoga wagon headed across the prairie, we don't get to think about efficiency. Because at the end of the day, the weather is going to determine whether we arrive at a destination on time or whether we arrive at all. And so we're going to be a byproduct of our environment. Trying to create all this new habits to make us more efficient or to create new ways of having methods of crossing the prairie is going to be draining on our neurosystem, on our bodies, because we have a goal, and that's to stay alive and reproduce. Mm. Anytime we start to manipulate that system, it becomes more taxing because your body wants to pull you back into what amounts to be stasis. So habits require intentionality and environmental design.
Yeah, very deep in thought as always, Eric. And again, that's the whole point of the show is to disrupt the way that everyone is thinking and feeling about these topics. And again, look, if you don't agree or disagree with us, that's fine. Put it in the comments. Let us know. We want your perspectives on this too.
Didn't we do an episode about weight loss, maintaining weight loss and the application to running a business, I believe, as well? I mean, there's one of the most fascinating studies about habits is that it's not enough to have developed a habit for some time. Mm-hmm. You have to cement and re-cement and continue to cement that habit oftentimes in order for something to be sustainable. And if you go back and listen to that episode, what's interesting is it's not singular faceted either, right? It wasn't like, oh, hey, I lost the weight and now I get to keep it off just because I still belong to, you know, Weight Watchers or whatever it is. It actually requires a multi-pronged approach that is highly intentional around environmental design in order to maintain that specific habit of weight loss. Now, this was pre-Ozempic, so I don't know, maybe things have changed, but at least prior to, the semaglutide phenomenon, that was what was required.
Eric, you're losing half the audience here. Just so you
know, what?
You're going too deep, too nerdy.
You don't think that our audience is Ozempic? You don't think they're on the Ozempic train? Okay, fine.
You really brought my attention out when you started about the wagon, and I thought I thought about Oregon Trail. Remember that?
Of course
game?
You did.
Of course. Right where my head went.
Yeah.
Maybe
you were worried you thought you were going to get dysentery, didn't you? You thought for sure that you were going to get stranded trying to ford the river with dysentery. We lost an oxen, damn it. I'll never forget.
I love it. So next great piece of advice, best piece of advice anybody's going to ever receive. Let's go down this line. Compete
subscribing
against
to this podcast. Fact. Yeah. Subscribing to this podcast. Fact.
Right away. There's a link somewhere. Hit the bell. You know, whatever the kids say these days. So compete against yourself, not against others. Agree, disagree. What are your thoughts on that one? Compete yeah. against yourself, not against others.
That's the healthy answer. No, I mean, that is truly the healthy answer. I think we're lying to ourselves and lying to others if we don't realize that there are some people who do have inherent benefits, that trying to compete with them is highly improbable. That mm-hmm. you'll actually end up achieving the result that you want, or you'll achieve a similar result. For instance, you probably should not compete, Greg, against Shaquille O'Neal. No matter how much you tell yourself you can, you should not compete against Shaq. However,
Wait a minute. I mean, if we're talking about free throws here, I'll probably compete against Shaq.
Yeah.
Let's be real.
That's right.
Anything else? No, probably not.
Probably not. But so there are some things you can't compete against, but let's take that exact same vein and say, if you look at Jordan and Kobe's success, a lot of their success was predicated on competing against other people psychologically, just among themselves, right? What you know is that kind of these famous stories of, you know, Jordan would go out and he would manufacture a competition with his competitors. And, you know, Kobe Bryant, there's a, you know, famous story of Kobe shooting, shoot around or whatever. And it was something like 3 hours before the game. And Jason Williams was at the gym and Kobe wouldn't leave until Jason Williams left. And so Kobe showed, because he wanted Jason Williams to know damn sure that Kobe was at the gym before he was, and he was at the gym after he was, and he was going to stomp him that day as a byproduct. That was his way of manufacturing competition in order to produce the best result that he could of himself. So I'm going to go with a partially true. Yeah. It's healthy to compete with yourself. Sometimes you have to manufacture external competition.
Yeah, I would agree with that too. I think that some people are more self-motivated than others. And in turn, I think depending on what you're using it as an example for, not to bring up Ben again, but I will bring up Ben.
Totally. Yeah.
You know, because I think that's a good example into one of the chapters of your life to help you elevate to your level, right? At the time to have some competition to say, wow, that's the benchmark. So I think that it is an interesting comparison to say. Now, I wouldn't overdo it where it's all consuming, where it's paralyzing, where then you huddle into a corner and you're defeated into this nature of comparison or competition against someone else. But I think there's a healthy level. So I would agree.
Absolutely. I love that perspective, because I'll pick on myself in this instance, which is just me telling the truth, is there's not an alternative universe that would have existed that would have made me, no matter how much time I dedicated and devoted to it, because I did. Mm-hmm. I spent a lot of time, energy, and effort on trying on getting better, and I still wasn't on his level.
There you go.
And you know, I was in the guy's wedding, right? And so we're good friends to this day. It was healthy competition in the sense that it gave me the perspective that I could still improve, or it gave me something to look to aspirationally as far as what's possible. Mm-hmm. But I was never delusional enough to believe that the skill of one of the top 30 people in the world, that I had that same ability at something that I thought I was pretty good at the time. There was mm-hmm. still a significant gap between a B+ and an A+. Mm-hmm. And I couldn't close it. Didn't matter.
But at the end of the day, I think that's kind of the example, and everybody can kind of reflect on that. And when there's been a healthy level of competition, and, you know, a lot of us go to sports if you're an athlete, that sort of thing, but you can take it to a lot of instances, that way for sure. So another piece of advice, or best piece of advice that anybody would ever receive, and I'd love your perspective on this: control the controllable. So control what you can control,
okay,
and let go of the rest. Let it go, as they say in Disney's Frozen. So what are your thoughts on that? Control the controllable and let go the rest.
I mean, that sounds like that's pretty accurate, because the inverse of that statement, I think, in order for that not to be true, is control the uncontrollables. And you're going to have a real difficult time controlling the things that are already uncontrollable. If you wake up pissed off because it's cloudy and rainy in Indiana today, you're going to be pissed off most of the days of the year, because mm-hmm. frankly, if it's not cloudy and rainy, give it a little bit of time and it will be. And so, you know, there are some things that, they are out of your control. In practice, it's far easier to say than it is to do. Mm-hmm. And look at my wife. My wife's just so good at that, at just letting go of things that she has no control over. Me, not so much. Yeah. Now, I still need a lot of therapy and a lot of time.
But that's honest, Eric. And I think so many people who are tuning into this, myself included, it's not easy to let it go.
No.
There's certain things that irritate and irk, and having the control in situation, it is an interesting factor to say, hey, you know what? There are very few things that we actually do have control on life. I take a case in point. As entrepreneurs or real estate professionals, look at what's been going on with everything, you know, into the environment and things along those lines. So many things from a business perspective that are out of our control. Yeah. And ultimately, are you going to let that consume you? Or are you going to say, hey, I'm doing what I can do every day to move the needle forward, to live the life by design that I'm looking for, and I'm going to let it go. And I think that, you know, to me, that is good advice, sound advice all the way through and through.
You know, and let me give you an example in that context of things that can be controlled in this real estate example is, at the end of the day, I don't get to decide a settlement. Mm-hmm. So that's uncontrollable. Now, mm-hmm. I work backwards from it and go, okay, well then what are the things that I can control that could potentially get closer to a result or a future reality that I think makes the most sense or that is preferential? And so in that instance, it goes, well, there's a lot of things you could do now. You could study on how to operate in the new post-settlement environment. You could contact the New York Times, the CNN. You could contact your congressman. You could vote. You could run for office. You can take out a billboard. You could go fly a blimp above Washington, D.C. There are a lot of different things that you could do. You could lobby the judge. You know, there's all kinds of things you could do. So there's very rarely a few things that are truly uncontrollable. It might be that the specifics that we want to control are uncontrollable, But unless something's done and over and in the past, most things can be influenced. Understanding the difference between control and influence allows you to have a much healthier relationship with it.
Beautiful.
I love this. And again, just kind of going through the best advice that anyone ever received. We got four more, Eric. Four more.
Okay.
We're done. We left some of the best for last. So if you're sticking with us, you're welcome in advance here to going through and to hear what Eric's got to say and kind of going through. So don't set yourself on fire to keep others warm.
Sure. Good advice. Most of the time it's good advice. Now, with that said, there's some outliers. Martin Luther King set himself on fire for a movement. My gut says he had others who were also on fire. He was more effective at being the face and the voice and the leader of a movement. But the reality of it is there's nothing more miserable than being surrounded by people who have disinterested and unmotivated and not inspired. And then you showing up every day and trying to pump their tires and get them pumped up. If you want to do that, go work at Orange Theory or become a spin instructor. That would be what your life is like. For the rest of us, hell no.
I love that. It is interesting. You mentioned Orange Theory, and I'm thinking, when I'm on the Peloton, I wonder what their life is like every day kind of doing that.
Caffeinated.
Yeah.
So much caffeine. It is what it seems like,
I would agree.
Yeah. I'm kind of envious of them. I'm not going to lie. I'm like, that is one of those jobs that I also realize if I was competing with, there's no chance, there's no universe that I could be a Peloton instructor. I just don't bring that level of energy.
It's tough. There's a special.
I look great in spandex. Don't get me wrong. I look fantastic in the spandex, though, Greg. I just don't bring the energy. That's the problem.
Let's get a picture floating on the screen here for everybody of Eric in spandex. Right, we'll put it right here. Insert that image. No, you all wish. You all wish that was a thing. So, coming down to the last three questions, or I should say, piece of advice, best pieces of advice that are out there. Take responsibility for your actions. Good advice, bad advice. What are your thoughts?
There's no other option. That is the only truth. Is at the end of the day, you at minimum have to take responsibility for your actions. Doesn't mean that you don't get to reflect and think about the chain of events that caused the particular series of actions. But if you don't take responsibility for your actions, who will?
Well said. I mean, I think taking responsibility for everything, there's a book, Extreme Responsibility. I think ultimately that's where everyone needs to kind of take a look in the mirror. And where I always kind of bring it to the equation is if you're looking at yourself and positioning as an entrepreneur, the way that you conduct yourself on a daily basis, right, with your colleagues, employees, team, whatever size of a business you're running, and having a reflection on it, would you hire you? I think that's a question or an aha question to say, like, hey, would I hire me to do what I'm doing? And if the answer is no, take responsibility, make the changes, make the adjustments. I think that that's really important. It's how we do everything. It's how we do one thing, it's how we do everything sort of mentality. So I agree, Eric. I think that's important. There's no doubt. Last two, we'll wrap this one up. It's okay to say, I don't know. Right now, I want to premise this, and just in case if my buddy Dave is watching, he is considered to be a know-it-all. He's the guy that knows everything, right? So
Dave,
you're
Ramsey?
Like, hey, man. No. I can't use his last name. But okay. He's my buddy Dave. If he's tuning in, if he's listening, he knows.
Okay.
But he's that guy. You say, hey, Dave, did you see this article? Oh, yeah, I knew that. Hey, did you know about? Oh, yeah, it goes this. He's that guy that knows everything.
Okay.
And what are your thoughts on the know-it-all? I mean, perspective? Is it okay to say I don't know, Eric? Agree, disagree?
Absolutely. Absolutely it's okay to say I don't know, except for the times when it's not okay to say I don't know. and what I mean by that is I can think of several instances where it wouldn't have made sense for me to say I don't know.
Mm-hmm.
And those are outliers. Most of the time, I would rather verbalize that I don't know than remain strategically incompetent and unaware. And so there are instances. I'll give you an instance. For instance, when I bought the Keller Williams franchise, I remember meeting with the people that I was buying the franchise from, and they, you know, were going through some numbers, and they're like, you know, here's the profit of the business, and here's how much money is in the account for retained earnings. And I just specifically remember thinking, what the hell are retained earnings? I have no idea what the hell retained earnings are, but these people are dumb enough to believe that I know enough to have bought this thing. So I probably shouldn't tell them that I'm a total moron. Now is not the ideal time to open my mouth and prove my incompetence. So I'll just shut up, and then I'll Google retained earnings when I get in the car. That's a good time to be, to not voice, I don't know.
Sure.
Most of the time, if you don't know, the best opportunity is just to find out.
I agree.
And I think that going to the equation of somebody pretending to know everything is nonsense. I mean, and quite frankly, ask yourself, everyone knows a know-it-all. Do you like them, really? I mean, every single time, they got to be right about everything. They know everything. I mean, who wants to be that person? And try to rephrase it in your mind. Look, maybe you're really smart, and maybe you do know quite a bit. But if somebody asks you a question, try refraining and saying, yeah, I already know that, da-da-da-da-da, instead of, well, I believe I know a little bit about it, but what are your thoughts? You don't have to tell everybody that you know everything. You can quickly say, I believe so, but what are you thinking?
Yeah.
How is that going to reposition the relationship and conversation? I don't know what your thoughts on that, Eric, but.
Yeah, let's be honest. Nobody liked Alex Trebek on Saturday Night Live. And so, of course, nobody likes to know it all. So you're spot on. There's no better example, except for Ken Jennings. And then he did actually know it all.
But there's a way. There's a way to position, as always, Eric. You know, we're people here, right? So last one, wrap this whole thing up. For the best pieces of advice you're ever going to receive in your life, right here. When people show you who they are, believe them. Do you agree? Disagree? Yeah. What are your thoughts?
You know, that makes that's a good quote for the girl who just got bangs after her breakup, and she's contemplating whether she needs a tattoo on her lower back, and she's wrestling with that quote, or you know, if a butterfly flies away and it doesn't come back, you know, she's wrestling on what exact cliche emblem of hurt and breakup she's going to use to display if the bangs aren't enough. The reality of it, I mean, is there any other sign that we've gone through a breakup than getting bangs? Come on. It's the universal love language of being unloved. And so the reality is that people are highly complex. They're multidimensional, multifaceted. Just because you get a Polaroid snapshot of someone at a moment in time, it is not a clear indication of who they are exclusively. Assume the best intent, and that there's something else behind that person that they're struggling with, that might just be an isolated incident. It's not a hard, fast rule of who they are all the time. I'm confident that who you were 10 years ago is not who you are today. So if someone held you accountable to the way that you were 10 years ago and didn't realize that you're no longer that person, they would have done themselves and you a disservice.
I think that's spot on. Too many people make quick or snap judgments based off of that one kind of quote or piece of advice that's out there. However, looking at it from a duality standpoint, I look at patterns, right? So If somebody is showcasing a behavior pattern again and again, then they are showing you who they are. You can then believe them at some point in a pattern basis, not a one-off sort of scenario. Agreed with that, Eric?
Oh, totally. Listen, I'm not suggesting that you would go and you'd, you know, have purple drink with P. Diddy. Okay. I mean, it is safe to assume that he's at least shown who he is. I don't think that that's advice I would give. That is on the opposite episode of some of the worst advice I could give you, which is to go to a P. Diddy party. And so there are those that when they display a pattern repeatedly, trust the pattern.
Agreed with that. And this is not a sponsor for Ciroc Ultra Premium Vodka, by the way, is this affiliation with P. Diddy. Eric, this has been a great one, my friend. I mean, I just love going through the best advice that anybody would ever hear, kind of going through. So hopefully you got some takeaways, everybody out there. You know, take a listen to this. Did any of this apply to you? Did any make a shift your thoughts? I can't encourage you enough to watch this again, share with everybody that's out there. And hang out with us on the next episode of Disruptance. Thanks, Eric.
Thanks, Greg. No P. Diddy parties this weekend.
That's right. Ciroc's in the building.